Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And it is now or never. And it is Feedback Friday. So what we need to cover today is actually quite a bit, but I actually have some good news that I'm tickled pink over this concept that the Convention of States is actually going after Republic Review. In other words, they've actually committed in, you know, taking a position regarding Republic Review. And, you know, well, you can obviously tell. We're going to get into a little bit of that today. But you can obviously tell that they really lack people who understand the Constitution involved in that entire, in that whole mess. And as a matter of fact, you know, just because Mark Levin is involved doesn't mean he understands the Constitution, because he'll be the first to probably try to contradict what I'm going to tell you. And what I'm going to tell you is exactly what the framers have told you. And so they've never gone into the details of this. They have never, they did everything they could to try to ensure that the states were happy while they had good, honorable men of integrity. When they started playing with political theatrics, and that actually really started in the 1790s with Hamilton and many other players, big government players who always tried to insinuate or basically imply the powers actually existed in the Constitution that didn't, such as a bank. I was just speaking with, I believe it was Woody, in regards to a bank this week. I challenge anybody to find how many times the word bank, separate with space, bank, space, just search for that word throughout the ratification debates and tell me how many times it appears, because the documents that I have, it was only used twice, and never once was it used in context to the federal government possessing, authorizing, operating, or being in the business of banks. Nowhere in there. So they have the good faith and credit of the United States. They can take out loans. And they even talk about taking out loans, of how they would have to pay debt and so forth. But nowhere in there were they authorized to create loans to charge people. In other words, to be able to loan to other banks and be in the business of making money. There's just no way that was ever. Had that actually been laid on the table, I'm telling you, the states would have rejected the Constitution. I mean, it was a close call. If you go through the ratification debates, there was very few states that had really almost a unanimous. Well, I take that back. The small states that didn't contend or didn't, you know, basically have a contentious argument, a vigorous debate over the Constitution, those states, you know, they were very happy with how limited the federal government really was. I mean, they saw it as an awesome, even Georgia even saw it as an awesome security to, you know, their rights, their powers, and everything else. They didn't question it. It was only the states that had these big cabals that already had big government and big government machinations. And these people were looking at, oh, there's all these opportunities are availing to us. What that means is the ability to oppress their citizens was now going to be in their hands. And they were actualizing on this under the Articles of Confederation. So we're going to get into a lot of this regarding that. But bottom line, the better and the more educated you are on the ratification debates, the easier it is for you to see and refute these paradigms, these arguments, these positions that people take. So why? And that's because, how was the Constitution defined? It was defined right there in the ratification debates by the framers. And they clearly stipulated the terms and conditions without the Bill of Rights. So we've got a lot to cover. I know that this is usually when we cover the presidential election. And, you know, I usually don't get into, you know, current events or anything else. But having lived in Hawaii and having witnessed, you know, how beautiful it is there and how, you know, how a lack of fires have ever been a problem. I mean, it's one thing for fires in sugar canes and stuff like that, sugar cane fields to, you know, to burn and so forth. But the extent of damage that hit Hawaii, I cannot fathom that as a natural fire. I can't. And so I don't know if we'll ever find out the cause of this, but it's just like the fires that we've seen. And I've been on the record over this. The fires we've seen in California and in other places where you have a swath of fire or you know, just this odd fire that it consumed these places that, why, how did those get consumed? And how did it spread the way it did? Anyway, I'll stop myself right there. What I do want to say, and I know that it has been since Monday, but since I talked about fasting, but I'd like to actually propose for those who are really serious in trying to, you know, have a better understanding, for those who are looking for deeper epiphanies and broadening their paradigm regarding the Constitution, I would highly recommend having more regular fasting and gorging on both scriptures and the ratification debates. Because I truly believe that those people who do that, they're going to be coming forward as champions of the Constitution. And we need more people to be champions of the Constitution and the limited government that it has created. Truly limited and defined. Now, one of the things that I was going to get into today, and I'm going to just touch on this barely, and I think that this is one of those things, because we've got time to get into the details of this, because it's not going to happen tomorrow. The fact is, they're going to try to start moving forward on this Trump trial. And so the question is, can Trump actually get a fair trial? And so Let's understand who it is that's actually going after him, and who, you know, who's his accuser. Is his accuser the federal government? Is his accuser the people? Because what is the federal government? What is our federal government? Is it we the people? Is it, you know, the an amalgamation of the states and people? Because when we really look at the government and the power and the sovereignty of the federal government, who is that? Is it the executive? No, it's not really the executive. The executive is the one, as I've told you, who has the responsibility of executing the constitutional laws and actually can step forward and not allow unconstitutional laws to be propagated or to be executed. But when it comes to the sovereignty and the assertion of sovereignty out of the federal government, that only comes from Congress. And so, in other words, when we look at, you know, the Department of Justice, well, that's not Congress. That's not even, you know, a Republican form of government. That is an executive who is using political power as a weapon against others and trying to use the legal system to exploit that power, so and prosecute and oppress others. So when we really look at the federal government and the charges and moving this into the court, because now it's going from the executive into the judiciary, right? Because the judiciary is going to be the ones that house this. I honestly believe, and I will tell you, that this is unprecedented, that a former president is being dragged into these charges after the fact. Now, they, you know, it's not that he can't be charged. You know, legitimate charges can come. But when you have a sitting president, when you have a sitting president that has actually committed the crimes, then that actually needs to be pursued as an impeachment. So we need to lay this all out, because what should the priority should be? Getting those in government right now who have been caught committing these crimes absolutely need to be pushed through for impeachment, if that is the only thing that we have. Now, with the current president, we actually have the whole point of Congress. I mean, this is such a web of deceit and corruption that it boggles the mind. But bottom line, there are many avenues to actually challenge the veracity of the president and what he's doing. But the first and the foremost one is the Electoral College, the unconstitutional Electoral College that seated him. And I have to bring it up. I got to keep on harping on this, that the states, that the 31 states that violated the Constitution in changing that manner, that unconstitutional manner is still in, it is still in vogue. It is still entrenched in these states. None of these states that I know of have undone what was done. So what are you going to do about 2024 when they pull the same stunts? Now there's, everybody's got these solutions to save America, and it all stems around the election process. You know, if that actually solved the problem, I'd be the champion for it. If that actually solved the problem. But all that does is it cleans up their ability to, you know, invoke corruption, you know, at an institutional scale. But the fact of the matter is, the real problem has nothing to do with the elections. The real problem has everything to do with our elected servants not demanding full compliance with the Constitution and demanding the full, you know, wrath or the support of the rule of law and demanding that the laws be complied to. And so I just have this huge problem with everybody saying that this is the Holy Grail. I really do. I have no confidence whatsoever. It's just like the convention of state folks. Oh, we're going to create these amendments, and this is going to be the gold lining that will become the gold standard of governing. Like, are you kidding me? Like, these guys actually believe, as a matter of fact, they're not even promising an outcome. But they want a blank check. They want the states to give them a blank check. So anyway, I will get into this, and we'll probably look at this with the ratification debates, but and we'll have to do this soon because I know this is going to move forward. But everybody that is giving you the analysis on this, I'm going to tell you right now that there's no reason why this cannot be a virtual trial. Where are federal courts? Their federal courts are all across this nation. And they can actually lock down a room to actually, if it's about justice and about a trial by a jury of our peers. And as a matter of fact, I think that this ought to be moved into a mode of a grand jury where we actually have, representatives from every state. At a minimum, one representative. I'm okay with two or three to make sure. Because actually, the greater the number, the harder it's going to be for you to get. And they know this, but you got to remember that when it comes to a crime, it has to be very crystal clear that the crime was committed. There cannot be a shadow of doubt. Anyway, they got a tough row to hoe, and I don't want to say I'm going to enjoy this, but you know, the impropriety, the lack of constitutional understanding, the lack of understanding our form of government and our legal system just truly amazes me. And this is how they've been able to do all of the things that they've been able to do. Now, I'm going to dive into what is the Office of Trust and Profit, right? Because the Constitution uses that term. But they're not the only ones. The states actually use that term. What is the Office of Trust or Profit? And how does that apply? And the reason I'm going to answer this, I'm going to dive into this today, is because Sue Venable wants to know. I think she wants to know. I know that her husband wants to know, but I believe Sue Venable wants to know. And so, you know, we're going to dive into this. And I have to kind of talk about, and we're going to have to dive into this concept of the invasion in sanctuary cities and states. As a matter of fact, what we're going to do, because this has really spurred the concept of, because they talked about how many billions of dollars they're spending on this invasion. And they're not spending on it constitutionally to repel the invasion. Just keep in fact, and keep in mind, that they're actually, because they said it would be too costly to repel the invasion. Are you kidding me? We're now spending $4 billion? Is that right? $4 billion? And I'm going, I would honestly think it's going to be more and more and more. And it is all of this that they're doing for this invasion is a direct violation. I had a detailed and deep conversation, you know, and kind of one outside the Constitution, one more on the spiritual grounds of this invasion and so forth, a moral grounds at least. And bottom line, the morality is that the laws state and are written in a very specific way, that the supreme law of demand, the supreme law of the land demands the repelling of the invasion. And so what are we to do? Our hands are tied. Even if we wanted to, even if there was that latitude to do it, it's not wise to do it. Because in reading doctrines, religious doctrines of how religions deliberately go after, you know, other nations so that they can actually subjugate them into a theocracy. We talk about this. The morality of all of that is absolutely evil. This is why the Bible warned of those types of things happening. I believe you'll find it either in Exodus or Deuteronomy that talks about the fact that you cannot allow your enemies to migrate and to actually be, you know, be enslaved or be there in your nation, because over time they'll continue to come and they will actually overpower you and subjugate you. That doctrine goes that far back. So this concept of we're obligated to do this, are you kidding me? Either we really are the stupidest people on the face of the earth, or they have done a really good job in manipulating everybody, because all of these shills, all these monkeys on a string that are out there, you know, pandering to, oh, this immigration crisis, and this is not an immigration crisis, this is an invasion. You cannot redefine what is happening. The Constitution's language is very clear. Immigration is a process where a person, before they come or cross the line, or they come to a port of entry, requesting to enter. That is the process of immigration. I am coming and I would like to come to America to work. I'm here to be a migrant worker, to work in the fields, or to, you know, to work on this property or do something. It doesn't matter. You have to request that permission. That is immigration. It is the legal process. Those people who come in like a thief in the night, who are basically trespassing on property they have no ability to be on or no legal right to be on, and all of a sudden we're saying, oh yeah, we're somehow, wink, wink, nod, nod, this is legal. You can't make something illegal legal. Anyway, but they're doing it, and this is how America is. It's got to be either the dumbest or truly the most manipulated society in the world. Truly, because there's not, well, I look at Europe. The Western nations, the Western societies have been completely manipulated, and they've lost their birthrights in many ways, and they're almost going to lose everything. We're becoming subjugated, and here's the thing. We're driving all of this. Now, the last thing I want to kind of get into before I kind of go into this office of trust and profit is the I heard about this, and I just go, I'm just shaking my head. Katy Perry is actually suing somebody because this guy, regardless of whether this guy did it and he was really drugged, and they could actually have proven this. They could have gone in because you can actually see how much and how the intensity of the drugs, and they could, okay, let's do a blood test. And if you actually pass, and okay, we'll consider, I mean, if you're in some reasonable realms of where you've actually, and I'm okay with that. But more importantly, let's look at this pragmatically. Here's somebody that believes they're entitled to take, regardless of how the conditions were that they convinced you to sell your mansion. And so here's a guy that bought this mansion to die. And for whatever reason, how he wants to dispose of this mansion really should be up to him. But the fact that they were able to come in right after his surgery and get him to sign a contract, that's suspect already. But then to try to force him off and to sue him and drag him into court, they say that there's no such thing as bad press. This type of press, this is like woke press, because when somebody believes that they're entitled to rip something out from underneath somebody who's actually making a legal and good legitimate claim otherwise, I mean, how is this a win for Katy and her, infamous husband? I mean, they're both becoming infamous because they're trying to stretch the law and they're trying to actually take, because they have the power of the purse to do this. These elitists are like independent nations, that they have their own lawyers to push and bend the law they want to. And as long as they can throw money into the pockets of the house or the host government, the state government or what have you, then they're going to corrupt it to gain their favor. This is how corrupt and how far we've gone. But bottom line, how come they never even said, you know what, we'll let you stay here. We still consider this a done deal, but we're going to let you stay here however long it takes for you to live. And we're going to actually pay for, the moving of your estate or moving of your things or what have you. We're going to help because we want to be good people. We honestly, maybe they didn't know, but if they knew that this guy was dying, they knew and they exploited the circumstance, that just makes them even look worse. You know what I'm saying? How can they actually, come out of this? There used to be a time when people would go out and break, burn, and destroy, the Beatles or what have you. I think that this is one of those moments where people just go, you've got to be kidding me. I'm not going to go see, Katy Perry ever again. If she feels that entitled to be able to take advantage of somebody who's dying, regardless if that's a mansion or not. If the person had the money and got into that mansion and they're dying, and that's where they want to die, they want to, they paid for it. Are you kidding me? Anyway, let's kind of dive into because I'm not going to do the gold today, and we'll probably cover this when it comes down the pike on Monday. We'll probably tell you what the weekend forecast, because I can just tell you gold, and I have no idea who's calling. Just ignore that line like I do. It's probably my wife, so I'm going to be in trouble. Anyway, so here's what we're going to do. We're going to dive into this Office of Trust and Profit, and just help you understand what this all means and put it into context of the Constitution. So an Office of Trust or Profit under the Constitution is a subset. It's an office like underneath the Constitution. But to be clear, the federal government has some real tight limitations. And so when we come back after the break, we'll dive into how this is defined on the federal government side. But you got to understand that the federal government is very constrained in contrast to states. So we're going to kind of expand this when we come back from the break, so we can dive into this in details. So we'll be right back after this.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Well, that was my beautiful bride calling. So, anyway, I was unable to connect with her after trying several times. But anywho, not that you care. So there are subset offices. In other words, these different categories for different types of positions in government. And you got to understand, in government, these are very limited, and these are predefined for the federal government. Because why? Well, I'll get into that. But they have honorary offices with no regular duties, no salary, or emoluments. In other words, an honorary office, and so apparently they can create an honorary office. That's okay. They can do that, but there's no emoluments, no salary, nothing. It's just, oh, you have it. And tell me again how a title of nobility is, because the federal government can't create titles of nobility, I thought, right? I mean, we'll get into that maybe some other time. Well, actually, we'll get into it when we cover the Constitution. But there are no person in the government can accept titles of nobility. I understood that the federal government couldn't create them either. Now, there's another subset or category, which is trust. An office of trust with regular duties that are not delegable, like a judge. In other words, there are appointments, and an office of trust is, you know, you're receiving a salary, emoluments, and so forth. And it's, you know, in some ways, because it's a federal position and it is lifetime, then it becomes a, you know, position of trust that actually doesn't expire. Now, then there's profit. Now, under the federal government, an office of this type of an office would be one holding a regular salary or other forms of emoluments, but this is not somebody that is elected. In other words, it could be an employee or something like that. But to be clear, to be very, very clear, because we need to, you know, place the limitation concept of profits under the federal government in context here. The federal government, under the Office of Trust or Profit, and we're really focused on profit, okay? So let's put aside the trust. The federal government has no delegated powers to create a for-profit corporation, company, business, bank. They don't have the ability to create a profit bank. They have the responsibility of banking their resources, their revenue, like, you know, having Fort Knox, all their gold and so forth. You could call that a bank, but it is not a commercial bank where people make deposits. It is strictly where the federal government retains its wealth or its backing for its currency. That's it. And so it has the ability to kind of, and I don't even want to use the word bank, because a bank has the ability to, you know, create loans for profit. The federal government could not do that. Go read the first Treasury Act. Even the minting could not make a profit. What the minting would do is, if you gave the mint 10 pounds of gold, it would give you 10 pounds of gold back in coin. All it did was it converted what you gave it into coin, and it was that simple. They weren't to make any money. So, and to be clear, the framers really understood that if you gave the ability to the federal government to create treasure, it would act like a king. It would act like a despot. It would act like a monarch in some form or another, because now it's developing wealth and now it has this net value. The net value is not the government. It is the people. So anyway, we look at the ability of the federal government not being able to create any of these, the bank, corporation, business, or anything like that, nor can it create a private entity of any kind. And I'll give you an example. It can't create a club, you know, exclusive members or anything like that, nor can it create a nonprofit or non-government organization. They have no authority to create these types of entities or to adjoin to other governments. They have no ability to do those things. These things are not enumerated. So this means that they have no authority to allow or not allow tax-exempt entities. This status, the taxable, tax-exempt status, is awarded by the states and should be awarded by the states. The states should have full control over this. There is nothing in the Constitution that allows them to do this. The way they started doing this is because of the 17th Amendment. You see, the states must report to the federal government those within the state that the state deems having income or a form of revenue that could be income. Now, there's nowhere in there that the federal government has the ability to actually tax income of companies. But whatever they call is income, and if the state defines that as income, the state would then basically report to the federal government that these are the entities that are making income, and technically the state, which would be the militia, would then actually create or invoke, because they wouldn't need to actually take up arms to go out and collect taxes. The states should be the ones that collect the taxes and basically put that into a repository and transfer that money to the federal government as accordingly. And that should all be done. So the federal government does have the ability to direct tax income, but they don't have the ability to determine who has income. They don't have the ability to say you can't make income, or you can, or you can't be nonprofit and you can. They don't have that power. They only have the power to direct tax income, which would then be defined by the states, because the states are the ones that have the power to create or define who has income and who doesn't, whether that's a tax exempt or not. See, if you read the Constitution and you read these amendments, you're going to find that there's no language that actually crosses these boundaries to make these assumptions or imply these powers. The concept of implied powers clearly doesn't exist, and it was argued by Madison that they don't exist. And it doesn't matter really what the federal government and Congress wants to say. Ultimately, this question has to go to the states, because it never has. And this is a part of the definitizing the Constitution. Once we actually get our arms around the terms and definitions, then some of these arguments then finally have to go to the states as they create this tribunal, and they have to wring this out. Did they have the intention of creating implied powers to the federal government? And I'm going to bet you the bottom dollar, a dollar to donuts, whatever your favorite adage is, I will bet you that the states will say, no, you have the power, we've delegated, you cannot imply otherwise. If you think you have more power, then you need to come to us to verify that before you start spending money and exercising that power. Because if not, we're going to come after you for fraud. Those politicians who made that assertion, see, Hamilton should have been charged and brought up on charges of fraud, defrauding the American people, and he should have been actually removed and banned for life when he started doing those things. The guy was a brilliant guy, and he created some really good systems. And I don't think he was a bad guy, but he was bad because he tried to stretch the law. So, anyway, bottom line, there is no enumeration in the Constitution. I want to make sure when I was referring to this, I was referring to the 16th Amendment. If I said the 17th Amendment, I've been arguing about that, or not arguing, been going into details talking about that and helping people understand that, because there's way too much misinformation regarding the 17th Amendment as well. Way too much. You know, these things were really written by idiots. And that's why there's so many problems with them, because these guys didn't understand the Constitution. And what they did was they created a real problem because they didn't understand the Constitution. They didn't really clarify, you know, how these things were going to be implied. Now, I believe I've pulled in the ratification debates. Actually, I could check, not the ratification debates, the debates in Congress regarding the 17th or 16th Amendment. I got it right here in my source material. I've got the 12th Amendment. I have the 13th Amendment, or I'm pulling in the 13th. I got the 14th and Enabling Acts. So I don't see where I've pulled in. I could have swore, and I think I do. I think I do have, it's probably the 17th Amendment, because there were real questions on, you know, whether they addressed the Uniformity Clause and all these other things. Not the Uniformity Clause, the suffrage of the fifth article and those types of things, the representation of states and so forth. But bottom line, you have to read the language and how Congress discussed and what they believed it meant when they sent that out, because that was the baseline of how it was packaged and given to the states, that this amendment, based on the language, we'll do this. And so then you have to go through all of the different ratification debates of the states as they do this. And so this is how we actually can confirm exactly what they can do and what they can't do based on that language. My ultimate goal is to actually have all of the questionable amendments like the 13th, 14th, and so forth, because we already got the 14th out there. But the ultimate goal is to have all of these amendments that were submitted so that we can compile not just the congressional debates, but to actually compile how the states ratified. In other words, the states' debates as they went through each of these amendments, because as far as I'm concerned, that's really the goal. In looking at how the lawmakers, or how the sovereigns at the federal and state level across this republic, perceive this. Because if they actually didn't make any, you know, assertion or mention of some of this crap that they've actually implied, because there's no evidence. I've yet to see any evidence. It doesn't mean that it doesn't exist, because I haven't seen everything. But I've yet to see, and I really have a hard time believing that they would have been that forthright in saying, oh yeah, this amendment's really going to screw us over. It's going to subjugate our people to making them chattel, that type of stuff. I just really have a problem believing that anything like that was ever revealed. And so bottom line, when it comes to contract law, if the words aren't there and it wasn't stipulated, that is not an applicable definition, term, or condition or stipulation for the contract or for that amendment to the contract. So, in other words, if they're trying to be duplicit, if they're trying to be sneaky, it doesn't work in the world of contracts. It either has to say it has to be said and stipulated, or it doesn't count. This is why the ratification debates are that important. But let me get back to this whole difference between states and offices of profit. See, the federal government has no ability to create any position of profit. None at all. And so that's why, you know, I just kind of review this when we look at this. You know, these offices of trust are very, or I should say offices of profit are very, very limited. Very limited at all, because when you really look at it, going back to the initial definition, an office of profit is someone holding a regular salary. Again, it is only an employee of the government where they're making money, but they don't have any responsibilities. They're not elected or anything like that. In other words, it really, the profit are employees. So when we go to, you know, the states, states can have employees. As a matter of fact, states have the ability and have the authority to establish corporations, companies, businesses, banks, private entities, even nonprofit and non-government organizations. Now, here's the interesting thing. There's nowhere, the Constitution prohibits states being allowed to let corporations come up with a compact amongst the state governments. And the federal government can't get in between some of these things. So in other words, each state has the ability to hold corporations to, you know, to constrain them, to pull them, you know, in. In other words, everything has been turned upside down. Corporations have become governments themselves, and they've become more powerful than governments. And it should be vice versa. States also, I already told you, the states also have the ability to create nonprofit and non-government organizations as well as private entities, clubs and so forth. I mean, you can create your own club in your state. You know, it's the club of people who wear glasses, you know, and in other words, you have to wear glasses to be a member. And you can have this elite society of those who are vision impaired. Boy, I would probably become an honorary member. Anyway, just because the federal government has assumed something does not make it legitimate. The states must delegate everything to the federal government before they can assume a role, responsibility, power, or property, period. Okay? So, when we really look at, you know, this thing called an office of trust or profit under the state and in the state constitutions, because many state constitutions hold people, as a matter of fact, I believe it's in the Missouri Constitution, where it talks about a person that is holding an office of trust or profit. At the state level, you can't tell me, because the states actually, one, have the authority to establish them, and they have the authority to regulate them. Understand what I just said. Doctors, medicine, pharmaceuticals, and so forth. The states have the responsibility and authority to regulate, not the federal government. The problem is that the federal government has basically got the states to allow all of these things. Folks, your state constitution is probably so sadly out of date because your state is doing things that many things that are happening within that state have been driven by mandates of the federal government. And this is where it gets interesting. This is where, when we look at pharmaceutical, when we look at bioengineering and some of this other engineering stuff, this, you know, that is really pushing the limits of morality. You know, if it hasn't been delegated to the states can actually step in and go, you know what? We don't like this. We do not like the fact that these corporations have been doing genetic engineering on plants and creating these, you know, I'll just say non-organic types of organisms within our plants or what have you. Folks, the sky's the limit as far as taking these things back. Anything that it falls within the realm of that state boundary, they have the ability to pull these things in. Don't think otherwise. These are independent and sovereign states that have joined a union with a very specific position, terms, conditions, and so forth. And they do not have to allow themselves to be subjugated to a polity, to actually a subcontractor that was created by them. This is just, there's no doubt in my mind. Madison is just going crazy. And I would probably presume that if it ever snows on his grave, it would never accumulate. It would just constantly melt because of the friction of him just spinning and spinning and spinning and creating so much heat. If people actually spun in their graves or rolled over in their graves, because I would think that he would be probably spinning, you know, on his way to the speed of sound and on his way to the speed of light. It is that bad. It is that bad. So one thing I wanted to get into as a little adage, because not adage, but getting back to something. I wanted to get back into this thing because I talked about this and I'm not prepared to. I just received these things right now, right before I actually sat down for this show. I received these images of this thing called the Convention of States attacking, believe it or not, they're attacking Republic Review. They're basically asserting that there's no legitimacy behind Republic Review. And, you know, and that's maybe the words, there's nothing founded in that, but the way the words are, it's really just like the Convention of States. There's no mention of conventions of states. There's an Article 5 convention. So the Convention of States is, you know, a group that has actually taken some real latitude and they've redefined things. So what I'm actually going to do is, because I think this is paramount, this is of the utmost importance, is what I want to do is kind of go through this argument. And so we've actually put these things up as a PDF on the website as important information. And it starts off, these are pictures of the screenshots. And actually, because we could put these into, you know, these pictures into Adobe, I've been able to extrapolate all of the words so I can cite them very specifically. But this is what they're saying. At best, a weak form of interposition. No enforcement mechanism, not mentioned by the founders. What? The words Republic Review or interposition? Republic Review is just it's a marketing label, to be clear, but it's just like judicial review. Is judicial review a marketing label? Technically, it is. It's a marketing label for the legal, for the lawyers, the legal beagles, or what have you. Show me in the Constitution where judicial review is authorized or even mentioned, and yet they do it. Ah, so the concept of federal or republic review or federal review, because our legislation, see, they're even aware because they actually talk about this. I'm going to go through what the negatives, what they're saying about republic review. Zero states, so at best, it's a weak form of interposition. That's the first bullet. The second bullet is no enforcement mechanism. The third bullet is not mentioned by the founders. The fourth bullet, zero states have passed a Republic Review bill. Requires the federal government restrain itself. See, these guys don't even know. So this bullet right here that says it requires the federal government to restrain itself, they haven't even read this stuff. Folks, go online and read clearly the bullets in the process of Republic Review. The federal government does not restrain itself. The states actually force the federal government. They have all the power to be able to force them. If you read Article 4 in the Constitution, the states can actually extradite their congressmen for any purpose of a felony and or treason. And so the fact is that any public servant, any congressperson who is not going to actually do things, you know, in pursuance to the Constitution and supporting their oath of office, when the states send directives that you will do this, if they don't and they actually vote against it, that vote will stand as an indictment. They will be brought back and to face trial, and they will be extradited and replaced. The governor will instantly send a replacement for that person who will now be standing trial, because that person will not be able to return in time to be able to do what's necessary. Either that, or they can quickly hand down the judgment and replace that person. So I'm just saying it could be very happily done by the states enforcing their compact. They have all the control over these people who think that they're immune because the globalists have empowered them. They didn't realize, and when you read the Constitution, their power comes from the states themselves. I mean, that is stated throughout the Constitution, that the power of the federal government is derived from the states. And anybody, so we're going to actually provide the ratification debate so that they can actually hear the founders' words. So we're going to really be picking this apart. And then behind this, the last thing they said, who was behind this? Cannot find any constitutional scholars associated with this idea. Ah, they don't want to mention me. Who's behind this? I'm not a constitutional scholar. Oh, because I'm not a professor. Oh, because I'm not somebody in government. I'm not a lawyer. There it is. I'm not a part of their club. But I would challenge anybody to actually have, and I'm not looking for a pissing match. I'm actually looking to say, let's sit down. I've asked the John Birch Society to sit down and actually have an open and honest discussion regarding the constitutionality and, you know, of Republic Review. And why is it that they take the positions on the Convention of States, which, you know, are laughable, and they're not really, they should have ended this discussion on the Convention of States a long, long time ago. There's no doubt in my mind, Madison would have pointed out the things that I'm pointing out. They're that obvious. And so we're going to get into a lot of these details in the next week or so. I just want to get these things up, and then we'll, you know, let you kind of look at them. But the PDF is up there, and it's on the important information. So you can actually see some of the information that they put up. And they only have one slide. I feel a little cited that they really thought that they could just dismiss me with one slide. And it's really not about me. They're dismissing something that is so important. It's so paramount. So I guess I'm personalizing this a little bit, but I shouldn't. This is something about you. This is something about us. This is something about our Constitution and the essence of the Constitution that they're dismissing. And I believe that I shouldn't be the only one defending it, and I don't believe I am. I believe that there's actually more and more people. So this is why I've basically put it out there. You know, when organizations actually fully come on board with full compliance and demanding full compliance to the Constitution, then we'll actually start. Because it doesn't matter if, you know, some scientist with, you know, these accolades or these, you know, degrees or, you know, whatever prominence, emoluments, titles of nobility. I don't care. When it comes down to what this Constitution is and what it says, I don't think you're going to find anybody that's actually going to be able to withstand the truth on the Constitution. What it ends up coming down to, every time I've argued with a constitutional professor, is, and it's not really a pissing argument, it is one of those discussions that says, you know, look, this is how we've been doing it for years. And I go, okay, so show me in the Constitution that says as long as we can get away with doing it, it's legitimate and galvanized in the Constitution, because I don't see that either. And, you know, every time they can't refute these arguments. So, bottom line, we've got a fight. We got a real fight on our hands. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
To become a citizen, one must take an oath to support and defend the Constitution. Those of us who are naturally born citizens are obligated and duty-bound to fulfill the same oath, even though we're not required to take it, because it is implied upon us at birth. This is why I cannot emphasize enough the importance in supporting businesses who are supporting our Constitution. We have to stop supporting businesses that have chosen to hide behind political correctness, and obviously we must stop supporting progressive businesses who are working to undermine our republic and our Constitution. Do not let businesses or organizations convince you that they are supporting the Constitution by supporting protests for social justice. By definition, social justice is the distribution of wealth, opportunities, and privileges within a society. In other words, they're calling for socialism, which is incompatible with individual liberty and individual sovereignty and our Constitution. With that, please consider supporting businesses who advertise on this show and this radio station.